And the next introductory course, I think, starts sometime maybe the end of April. And in these first few meetings after the introductory course, I continue as if the introductory course never ended. I just continue with themes and topics to kind of build on the course and hopefully interesting for everyone. And the first topic that I'd like to talk about for this evening would be what's known as the five hindrances. This is a very important topic for people who do this kind of meditation. Or it's an important topic for anyone who wants to live a life that is to some degree awake, some degree present, mindful of what's going on in their lives as they live their lives. And the reason why it's important to become aware of these five hindrances is that, and according to the way the Buddha categorized things, these are the five forces of the mind which make it most difficult for us to be present. And maybe I suspect that many of you, all of you, were visited by the hindrances during this last half an hour. Unless you were able to be pristinely present for every single moment of the whole half an hour, chances are your mind wandered off into one of these. So they're called hindrances because those which hinder our ability to be present. And there's many things you can point to that hinder our ability to be present: fear, inhibition, desire. This is a particular list the Buddha thought was a particularly powerful forces. The five hindering qualities of the mind. And these are desire, the first one. The second one is ill will, sometimes called aversion. The third is restlessness and anxiety. The fourth is this wonderful term, sloth and torpor. I never use the word sloth except when I give this talk. And the last one is doubt. So these can be very powerful forces, not only in meditation practice, in a life of trying to be mindful, but they're actually powerful forces in the rest of our life also. And just a little bit of reflection would show that these things operate, in our society, really prevalent forces. Now, before I go into them, one of the things I want to emphasize is that one of the tenets of Buddhism, very important teachings of Buddhism, and that is, rather than pursuing the ideal, Buddhism emphasizes understanding the actual. If there's a gap between the ideal and the actual, pay attention to the actual. And it works this way, that if you pursue the ideal without noticing what's actually happening with you, without being really truthful about where you're actually at, it can be an artificial construction of the ideal. You can kind of put a veneer over yourself. You're trying to be compassionate, trying to be present. And it's kind of a veneer of compassion, of kindness, of whatever, rather than something that's really deeply heartfelt. But if you go in and really address what's actually happening with you, even though it might be undesirable and unpleasant, that's really getting back into the root of what's really going on with you at the moment. And you can trace that back into your heart, in a sense, into your core of who you are, to find your core motivation, your core intention that you want to live from and help hopefully live in a more honest and truthful way. This is one of the reasons why in Buddhism we tend to be a little bit mistrustful, not that it's always a bad idea, but a little bit mistrustful of the whole movement of positive thinking or affirmations. Because affirmations have a tendency of kind of putting a veneer over what's actually happening. I'm depressed, so I'm going to say to myself over and over again, I'm happy. And you might have a semblance of happiness over that, and maybe to some degree you are a little bit happier, but a person really hasn't understood the roots of depression, and really understood them in order to be free of them, in order to resolve it and clarify it. And the function of mindfulness practice is really to get down to the root of our psyche and really understand the depths of it, rather than just to kind of overlay some ideal on top of it. So mindfulness practice becomes kind of a truth-telling practice. We want to be really truthful about where we're actually at. The actual is a doorway to the ideal. So we want to really be honest where we're at. We don't want to sit down and say, well, I don't like who I am today, so I think I'll pretend I'm someone else and then try to wake up. We want to be present for who we are. And so these five hindering qualities, rather than thinking of them as being bad or the enemies of your spiritual life, think of them as being as being the doorway into getting deeper into your life, greater intimacy, greater depth of spirituality, depth of presence in your life. But really learning how to be honest with these, seeing them honestly when they arise, and learning how to recognize them when they come, even from a distance. Really recognize them when they just begin to happen. Not simply to notice that you're in the throes of desire, 10, 20 minutes, 24 hours later. Don't end up find yourself suddenly married to a millionaire in Las Vegas. And said, oh, I wasn't thinking very clearly. the hindrance of desire somehow got the upper hand here. So to recognize these things when you just begin is very important. And so one of the tasks of mindfulness is to learn to recognize these things, to become a connoisseur of them, to not think of them as problems, but think of them as really, oh, this is a chance for me to develop my ability to be mindful by really noticing what it is that tends to take away my mindfulness. So in other words, the five hindrances are kind of the place, the things which make it difficult for us to be mindful. It's really beautiful because it means that we pay attention to that which makes it difficult for us to be present. Isn't that great? Rather than kind of think, oh, it's terrible, I hate that part of myself, or kind of slash and burn kind of approach to parts of our psyche. And it's like we're really interested in that part of us which makes it difficult to be present. And that does two things. It makes us present for something, for that, even though it might be unpleasant. But also it teaches us to become real connoisseurs, real experts at recognizing these forces when they appear, so that we have the upper hand, so that mindfulness is stronger than these powerful forces. The analogy I like to use is that of a black hole. The five hindrances are like these five black holes in the mind. When they're operating strongly, awareness gets sucked in, just like light gets sucked into a black hole. Light doesn't come out. So when light gets sucked in, when awareness gets sucked up by desire or ill will, it doesn't come out and you hardly even know what you're doing because you're so lost in that world, or can be. So the first is desire, and the second one is aversion. And these two kind of are partners, they're kind of like opposites. Desire is wanting, and aversion is wanting it to go away, pushing it away. What's interesting about these first two is that they almost always involve an object. There's something that we want, something we want to push away, we don't like. And so when we live in the first of these two hindering qualities, the mind is involved in objectifying reality. It's living in the world of objects. You know, we have this thing, you know, being sex objects. You know, someone treated me like I was an object. It felt really terrible. To treat the world as objects is a little bit heretical from the point of view of Buddhism. Because in a sense, there is nothing outside of us. From the psychological understanding of the Buddha, or from this understanding of awakening. Of course, there's things outside of us. We're not denying that. But in the empirical world, or let's say the phenomenological world of our direct experience, we don't experience things as being separate from us. We have to kind of construct an idea that it's separate from us. The seeing happens not out there. It happens when light contacts our retina, and then whatever happens in the brain as a result. You hear someone speaking. It isn't that that voice is happening outside of you. You're hearing that voice because of what's happening and resonating, what's the waves inside of your own ears. When you touch something, that touching is intimate. It's not separate and outside of you. There's sensations within you that are feeling that. So if that makes sense to you, from that point of view, Buddhism says nothing is outside of you. But to relate to something as an object outside of you is a kind of a problem. And what we're trying to do is to feel life much more intimately than that out there. So it's most problematic in these first of these two hindering qualities. I want that thing. I don't want that thing. As opposed to just simply experiencing it in the holistic field of awareness. It doesn't have to be considered as an object inside or outside of oneself. One of the great, interesting discoveries that some people have on retreats, they come to retreats expecting these 10-day Vipassana retreats to be silent retreats. So they're expecting, you know, pristine silence. You can just hear a pin drop or whatever. And you come down, and this is your chance to get fully, perfectly enlightened, and this is, you're really happy, this is your chance, and you finally got there in a retreat. And the person next to you snorts, sniffles, coughs, has this down parker on that every time they move a lot, kind of crackles. And they seem to be always crackling their knuckles, you know. And like, what's this person doing? This is a silent retreat. And they're disturbing my retreat. They're disturbing my serenity, my peace. And we treat it as an object which is disturbing us. And then inevitably someone will come on these retreats and say, this person near me is just bugging the hell out of me. Can't you kind of get rid of them? Or, you know, what can I do, you know? And they're living in this world as if there's an outside and inside. And what happens after some days, they'll come back and say, you know, there is no outside and inside. It isn't like a sound outside of there that's disturbing me inside of here. It's just like the birds singing, you know, just like the stuff that's going through. What was happening before was I had this wall of self, this wall of my desires, my needs, my retreat, my enlightenment, that I was protecting and holding on to, and that sound was colliding with that wall of self, this wall of that I was creating. But when I dropped the wall, it wasn't a problem anymore. And there was sense, like it was no sense of, even that those sounds was outside of me. It was no longer an object outside. It was just what was happening. Does that make some sense to you? And then they say, well, it wasn't a problem, it wasn't a hindrance. It was actually, my meditation developed quite nicely with this person making all their noise. There's no distractions in mindfulness practice unless you put up a wall. Unless you put up some idea or value or clinging that the so-called distractions is encountering, some interpretation and idea. So my teacher in Burma, when he first started meditating in the monastery, he had a roommate. Now, my teacher was just—he was kind of like this warrior approach to spirituality. He was just full of dignity and very powerful man. And when he did things, he was kind of just threw himself in with great diligence and seriousness, and kind of a perfectionist kind of type. And his roommate was this no good, lousy, lazy bum, you know, who's. So my teacher, he would stay up late at night to meditate and get up early in the morning, meditate in his bed. And this guy, his roommate, just would go, you know, sleep first chance he got, and, you know, and didn't meditate much. And on top of that, he snored. So the first few nights, my teacher was sitting there meditating, you know, and, you know, what? Same thing, you know, this guy's disturbing my meditation. What a distraction, you know, I can't meditate with this kind of distraction. And after a couple of days of this, I won't resist it anymore, but I'll take the snoring as the subject of my meditation, the focus of my meditation. So I'll forget about the breath. I'll just do listening meditation on the snoring. And he just listened, and he let go of all his ideas and all his judgments and everything else, and just listened to sounds. And he got very concentrated, and it became his entryway into a deep world of insight meditation. So rather than thinking of things as being problems, we take them to be something to pay attention to. And it's really an interesting way to shift your life. Stop looking at life as having problems, but rather looking at life as offering you things that want your attention, that need your attention, that you want to bring your attention to study and get to know better. So the desire and aversion have to do with objectifying the world, something I want, something I don't want. Desire is camouflages itself very well Because when we're lost in desire, it's often pleasant. It can be very pleasant, unless we're frustrated in our desire. But the fantasy of desire, we're sitting here meditating, we have some wonderful fantasy of desire that the mind goes off into. They're usually somewhat infatuating. You're thinking about how wonderful it would be to be in, you know, in Tahiti right now, rather than meditating here in wet California. And so it's when we have wonderful thoughts and ideas about Tahiti and how great it would be and who you'd be there with and, you know, all these things. And it's very pleasant, it's very alluring and enchanting to be caught up in that. So it's sometimes very difficult to see when the mind gets, when the awareness gets hindered by getting infatuated by desire. Aversion, sometimes people are infatuated with also. And some people get a lot of sense of vitality and energy from getting filled with rage and anger, and they like that feeling of vitality because it's the only way they get it in their life. Or a sense of being self-justified or self-righteous by being able to criticize someone else. But usually the hindrance of aversion tends to be more unpleasant than the one of desire. And so people are often much more motivated to try to overcome being lost in their aversion. And some people actually will take being lost in their desires as being a vacation. You know, so they don't really want to try to wake up. But the important thing is to recognize these things when they occur. See them very clearly. Oh, this is a desire. My mind is caught up in desire and wanting. It can want anything at all. You can be sitting here meditating, and simply the chair you're sitting in isn't just quite as comfortable as you could think it could be. It's a little bit uncomfortable. And so you start desiring a better chair. Maybe the chair, some of these chairs have armrests, you know. Oh, what would we like to have an armrest? You know, my arms are a little bit tired, kind of, you know, to support them would be great. And you fantasize, you know, about what it would be like to have an armrest and how, get an armrest, you probably get enlightened with no time. And so the mind kind of goes down the track of desire. And it can be, you know, much more gross, you know. It can be thinking about desiring, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow at work, or planning your career for your whole life, or there's all these things we want, and we get swept up in it so easily. Or it can be aversion. You know, sitting here, we're a little bit uncomfortable. We're not desiring a better seat, but rather we're thinking of all the ways we can destroy the seat we're in. You know, and criticizing, how could these Buddhists have chosen this particular place to have their meditation classes where they have such bad seats? I mean, there's all these churches in Palo Alto, and certainly they could have chosen a place that had better seats. And who are these Buddhists anyway, choosing such bad seats? And by the way, why are they having these classes on Thursday anyway, you know? And you know, could do it Wednesday, be better. So the mind very easily sometimes get caught up in aversion, wanting things different, kind of attacking things. This is the problem, seeing the problem in things, and want to get rid of it, push it away, and be critical. And in either case, whether it's desire or aversion, if we're swept up in it, if we're preoccupied in it, we're not awake, we're not present, we're not mindful of what's going on. It isn't that we need to stop being desirous or stop being aversive. It isn't that we're making these the enemy of our spiritual life. But rather what we're learning to do is not to have them get in our way, not to have them be black holes, to let our mindfulness be our awareness, let our mind be strong enough so that we have the upper hand, so we're really present and aware, knowing they're happening. If we know that we're involved with aversion or desire, if you know it clearly enough, you're not caught by it. And that's all we're asking. When this is not a war zone of, you know, trying to get rid of, you know, get rid of parts of who we are. It isn't like any part of, we don't consider any part of ourselves as being bad or wrong. All we're trying to do is to wake up to it so that our mindfulness becomes stronger than it. And if we do that, then we can choose to live much more responsibly and wiser in our lives. One of the rules I have for myself is when I notice that I'm in the midst of a hindrance attack, lost in a hindrance, so basically hardly coming out of it at all, that I try not to make decisions when I'm filled with a desire or filled with aversion or anger, but rather wait until I'm not caught by it, not preoccupied by it, and then I'll make the decision that has to be made. Because I've learned that if I make the decision while I'm in the middle of my hindrance, then I often make unwise decisions. Now, these hindrances, The Buddhist word for them is not actually hindrance, maybe a poor English translation. The Pali word is nivarana, which translates more literally as coverings. So that which covers our awareness, covers our deeper integrity, covers our ability to be deeply in touch with ourselves, covers perhaps our deepest intentions. And so one of the interesting things to ask yourself or to explore when you find, when these hindering qualities come up, is what is it covering? What's it covering up? For example, desire is often a cover for something deeper going on inside of us. If we feel uncomfortable in some way, we feel maybe some lack of self-worth or some lack of being, not feeling kind of insufficient or inadequate or lonely or guilty or filled with shame or all kinds of feelings we might have about ourselves which are uncomfortable. One of the functions of desire sometimes is to hide that from us or to cover it up, to make things better for ourselves, to kind of hide from it by kind of losing ourselves in something very pleasant. And we do it regularly, many of us. You know, we turn on the television, we go to the refrigerator, we go to the movies. And we do things which kind of are pleasant as a way of getting away from, escaping from ourselves. And the mind is very tricky in this way. And sometimes when you find yourself lost in strong desire, and it's very hard to wake up from it, ask yourself, is there something that it's covering up? Is there some deeper thing that's actually going on in here for me? Same thing with aversion. What's it covering? It might also cover some feeling of something's kind of being on or off. Maybe the same ones as the desire might cover. It's just a different strategy of how to try to deal with it. If you're feeling kind of, I'm feeling kind of inadequate or kind of lonely or kind of, you know, bad about myself, I don't want to look at that. So I think I'll find someone to criticize. You know, that person's wrong, that person's bad. And it's a lot more pleasant, perhaps, you know, to kind of find something, everything wrong with someone else as a way of avoiding how we're really feeling ourselves. So we have to kind of go in to wake up and be really honest, to wake up and be really learn how to be present. We have to learn how to be present for that which about ourselves which we're not comfortable with. If you think that spiritual life is only about going from greater and greater beauty, greater and greater pleasure, you're in trouble. It's about becoming increasingly honest about who we are. And that means being willing to be present for parts of ourselves that we don't find comfortable. Without that willingness, you can't wake up and become free. So desire and aversion arise, and we try to see it clearly. We try to notice it, maybe sometimes naming it, desire when it arises, desire, aversion, is very helpful to free us from it. But it can be very hard to kind of free the awareness enough to see it really clearly and not get sucked back in again. And so one of the ways to help us with that is to feel what it feels like in our body to have the desire and the aversion. Not to get caught up in just noticing the thoughts about desire and aversion, but noticing the felt sense in the body, what it's like to be desirous or aversive. It's fascinating with these things to feel how the center of gravity shifts sometimes. And when there's desire, sometimes we move forward a little bit. And if there's aversion, we kind of move back a little bit. They're kind of reaching forward in desire. You can watch this sometimes. You know, if you're walking to lunch someday, notice where your center of gravity is. Notice how you're ahead of yourself. Notice, you know, it's kind of a reaching. Or if you're going, you're going to meet someone who you really don't want to see. Maybe your boss has called you in for an important meeting. Oh, you know, notice how maybe there's kind of a tight thing, a kind of resistance in your body out of that aversion. But start noticing what's going on in your body. Where it gets tight, where it gets constricted, where it gets leaning forward. How desire aversion manifests itself in your body is a very effective way to learn how not to be caught by desire and aversion. It's a way of learning how to be present for it without being tricked by the stories connected with it. So one of the ways to wake up and be present is to feel it in your body. The next two hindrances also are peers, restlessness and anxiety on one hand, kind of agitated states, and then sloth and torpor on the other side, kind of fatigued or down kind of states, energized states and de-energized states. And now restlessness can be a real challenge to sit with when we're meditating, because restless doesn't want to sit still, and we're trying to sit still. And it can be quite dramatic. Sometimes it can feel like you're riding a rodeo. You're committed for half an hour to sitting still and just being mindful. And in order to do that, you have to break out into sweat because your legs are about to bolt for the door. Now, and then your mind is very clever to justify and come up with all kinds of reasons why you shouldn't sit there with all this restlessness, why you should give into it. No one's ever died of restlessness. And it's very powerful and very effective, very freeing to commit yourself to sitting still in a gentle way. It doesn't have to be kind of tight, and not giving in to the restlessness, and just let it course through your body and to feel it in your body. Restlessness in particular is useful to feel in your body. What's happening in your body as you feel restless? Your legs, your arms, your chest, your hands, your face. And sometimes it can feel like this huge ping pong balls are kind of flying about inside. And just make your body as big a container as you need to be in order to hold all that energy. Just hold it and let it kind of do what it wants within you. And probably what you'll find is that it settles down pretty quickly. You have to expect that sooner or later, if you're meditating regularly, you're going to encounter restlessness. And so rather than, now you've been told to expect it. It's not a problem. It's just one of the hindrances. It's not getting in the way of your meditation. It becomes how you develop your meditation by learning how to be present with the restlessness, how to develop some strength to it. Maybe investigate, what is that covering? Is restlessness covering something? Maybe it's something you really don't want to look at. And so it's better to be restless. And so if you're restless, you kind of, you know, you're kind of trying to get away. It's kind of a form of escape sometimes. And then sloth and torpor they're not just physical fatigue, but they're kind of, they arise kind of as a form of resistance to being present. Because it's not always so easy to be present, sometimes we become kind of, it's like a whiny kid. Or like I like to call it my Sears mind, because when I was 10 years old, my mother would take me to Sears to go shopping for clothes, and I hated it. And as soon as we walked into Sears, I would get really tired, phenomenally tired. And as soon as we left Sears, my mother offered, you know, you'd like to have some ice cream. There was nothing wrong with my energy level. I was just quite energetic. The fatigue was a kind of resistance. You know, I'd kind of give up. I'd kind of drain my energy. So to look at fatigue, and if it's just physical tiredness, maybe you're better off just going to sleep. We're a sleep-deprived culture. If Buddhism is going to help us live more healthy lives, it encourages us to get more sleep. But if it's not just simply physical fatigue, but you know something deeper, then you can look and say, what's it covering up? What am I not paying attention to? Is there resistance here? Sloth and torpor. It can have a physical aspect and it can have a mental. Sloth is more physical and torpor is mental. The mind becomes like quicksand or like thick, gooey stuff. All these kind of dull. Doesn't seem to want to work. One of the things that can be very effective with sloth and torpor is rather than giving into it or giving up, or rather than kind of believing it, or rather than resisting it, or rather than kind of pulling back and, you know, is to actually turn the awareness directly at it and look exactly, pinpoint within your body, pinpoint within your psychophysical being, where the sensations of sloth and torpor reside. Where are they actually in you? Can you feel the heaviness in your face and the eyelids and your shoulders? Maybe, can you feel where exactly in your brain, in the mind, does that dull experience, that kind of clouded feeling seem to be. And there's a kind of way in which we look very carefully, very mindfully, bring some energy of mindfulness to look at the very place where we're tired. That itself tends to wake things up and clarify things. In any case, that's what the practice is to look very carefully at the heart of what's going on. And if you're sleepy or slothful, you will look at the heart of that, what's actually happening for you, rather than staying one or two steps removed, thinking about it. If we stay a couple of steps removed, thinking about any of the hindrances, then we more likely we're kind of caught by them. Still kind of preoccupied, easily pulled into them. But the idea is to bring the mindfulness into them very closely and see them clearly, being very honest and see them for what they are. The last hindrance is doubt. And doubt is said to be the most dangerous hindrance because doubt is the hindrance which will most likely get you to give up the practice. You know, I doubt my ability to do this. I can't do this. I'm not the right person for this. This is not the right day for it. It's not the right hour for it. This is not the right practice for me. There must be better practice than this. This is not the right group to be meditating with. This is not the right teacher. You know, we have all this doubt. You know, I don't know what to do here. Should I pay attention to my breath? Should I pay attention to the person snoring next to me? I don't know what I should do. I'm not good enough for this. The mind can be filled with these thoughts of doubt. And it's dangerous because we can believe them all too easily. And if we believe them, then we can say, well, forget this. I think I'll go to the movies instead. It's very important to recognize that we don't have to believe our thoughts. And for some people, that's a really radical idea. Because some people think that their thoughts is who they are. So any thought we have must be really true and you know, worth having it. But we don't have to believe our thoughts. You live a life that's a lot easier, more easeful, if you don't believe every thought you have. But just let them go. Just, oh, that's an interesting thought. But in particular with doubts, you don't have to believe them. But rather what we're asked to do is to recognize it when it occurs. Oh, this is doubt. I heard about this, and it's happening. This is doubt. I'm having a full-blown attack of doubt. Isn't this interesting? Here's a human being who's full of doubt. I was told in that class, oh yeah, when doubt occurs, you can expect it. I'm supposed to just notice it, as opposed to give into it or believe it or get sucked up in it. Oh, and it's a rather unpleasant doubt. It's all about doubt about me. Wow. Imagine. I'm sure I'm not the first person to doubt myself. I'm not going to be the last person to doubt myself. Every meditator doubts themselves sooner or later. Now it's my turn. Wow, let's notice this. What does it feel like to have doubt? What's it about? What does it feel like in my body? Maybe there's kind of feeling of resistance in the body or hesitation in the body. Doubt always often has with it a quality of hesitation. We hold ourselves back from really throwing ourselves into doing the practice or doing anything that we're trying to do. And doubt also can be a covering. It's interesting to explore under the surface of doubt. Maybe doubt is arising out of an interpretation that our spiritual life is supposed to unfold in a particular way. And my life is not unfolding the way it's supposed to unfold. Therefore, maybe I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I can't do this. Maybe I'm not the right person for it. We have all these doubts. If we have this idea that what's supposed to happen is we're supposed to get calm or blissful or serene in a direct linear way, just, you know, and then you don't do that, then there can be doubt. So there might be an interpretation that's the hook for your doubt, that's feeding the doubt. I read a letter, or a letter some years ago of a I think it was an American priest who went with a church group to Mount Athos in Greece, which is a place of great Greek Orthodox Christianity monastic center, all these monastic temples there. And they were going there on tour, and they met this old monk who'd been there for maybe some 45 years. And the monk said to them, monk was kind of bitter and sour. And they asked him, why, what's going on with you? And he said, I've been here for 45 years and I still haven't learned pure prayer. And the person who's recounting this in the letter said, well, what was really sad was not that he'd been there for 45 years and still hadn't attained pure prayer. What was sad was that after 45 years of being in the monastery, he still expected to attain it. It's not about attaining some great purity, some great beauty, but rather it's really learning how to be ruthlessly honest about who we actually are, not who we're supposed to become. In that ruthless honesty of being present for ourselves as we are, there's the opportunity of becoming free of these forces that drive us, that compel us. And it's the freedom from all compulsion which will make you peaceful. Not the freedom from any particular state or thought or ideas. Make sense? So now you've been warned about the hindrances. Don't expect, you can expect them. They're part of our human nature. And you can just, you don't have to be welcoming of them exactly, but don't be discouraged when they appear. One of the things this means is that when you're trying to do a mindfulness meditation that involves trying to learn to become mindful in the present moment, stay in the present moment, mindful of what's happening, the very things which are distracting you from the present moment, you have to learn to pay attention to those carefully. So rather than just always pushing away the distractions, you want to turn towards the distractions and learn to wake up in the middle of them. And then once they've been taken care of, then you can come back to your breath and continue that way. So I hope that made some sense tonight. So now is your turn if you have any questions that you want to, for clarification or whatever. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. Or we are all having a sloth and torpor attack. Do any of these states sound familiar?
I just want to say something kind of funny. When you named off the hindrances at first, I thought the last one was death.
Death?
and then... Really?
Oh. Because I wasn't.
You said doubt. I said, woo! Doubt, not death. Because I was like waiting to hear what you had to say. It's dead. Anyway, I thought that was
nice. Okay. So I guess I wasn't pronouncing my words very well. Yes?
During meditation, I knew I was distracted.
Yes. If you know you're distracted in that moment, you're mindful. Yeah. If you know what's going on, you're present. But if you get lost in it, if you know it for a moment and then you get lost in it again, then you've lost your presence.
But by knowing it, doesn't mean that should make it go away?
No, it means that you're mindful of it. If then once you're mindful of it, you can bring more attention to it. And the stronger the attention, the stronger the light of awareness is. It really recognizes what's going on.
So that, like analyzing it?
No, just really seeing it. It's like unless it was too personal, what were you being distracted by? Well, thinking about later might be okay, but in meditation, we're not trying to analyze anything. There's no need to think about and figure anything out, but rather you want to see it clearly as an event in the present moment, not something to figure out. We use the non-discursive ability to have non-discursive awareness to just see it. Oh, there's a conversation happening.
That's it.
And you might, if it continues, you might just name it. Talking. Just to name it. And if it's very compelling, if it's very compulsive, that kind of conversation, then you might want to look a little bit under the surface of it. What's covering. And probably it's some emotion. And then if you don't connect to the emotion will keep wanting to have that kind of conversation. But if you can really honestly connect to the emotion, then it tends to quiet itself. But that's not analysis. It's just kind of looking, in a silent awareness to see what's going on more carefully.
So you allow yourself that moment to observe that, be aware of that, and then go back to the prayer.
You can do that way. If a person's new to meditation, then we mostly just teach them to just go back to the breathing, and that's really helpful. But if a person knows about mindfulness practice and received the full instructions, then the basic idea is that we pay attention to whatever is most predominant in our experience. So if there's some strong sensation in the body, or some strong emotion, or some strong thought that's going on, then we bring our attention, our silent, non-discursive, calm, meditative awareness, to pay attention to that event as long as it's there. Being very careful not to get caught up in our thoughts about it, but to stay there in that kind of spacious, non-discursive awareness of it. Yes?
I just wanted to add something.
Please.
From my own understanding about what's next, when observing just the thoughts or whatever that are there, to recognize, to kind of de-link, to look at the sensations in the body that are associated with those thoughts, emotions that are associated with those thoughts, and then anchor it back in the bodily sensations. And then over time as you, this is my understanding of the practice, but over time as you do that, what gets integrated in life is that when those events happen that might have an emotional component, you anchor again in the bodily sensations and have the distance that you attain in the meditation. That's what you've taught about. But I thought that that's also an answer to what's next, in a way, in addition to just, again, looking.
Right. The if something persists through time, sometimes there's the whole art to learning how to pay attention to mindfulness. It's not something you can. It's very simple to teach it. There's kind of a whole art to know how it works in our daily life and how it's useful to use it. But if something persists, like a strong feeling or a strong thought persists, one of the most useful places to be aware of it is in the physical embodied experience of it. Most of us live in our world of our thoughts, and we kind of think that the world of our thoughts are really significant. And actually, the world of our thoughts actually keeps us fragmented and keeps us not completely whole. And so for most people, to balance who we are, and to it's useful to kind of go back into the felt sense of what's happening. What's the felt sense of being lost in a conversation? What's the felt sense of being filled with desire? What's the felt sense of being filled with doubt? And the felt sense is a bodily experience, or as the woman nicely talked about, kind of anchoring ourselves in the body. And that for some people creates a very important balance. And the body is not a story. The physical part is not a story. So in that you can feel it, the physical component part of any experience, then you're less likely to get swept up in the story part of what you're experiencing. And the story part has no bearing or importance for your meditation, for the point of view of your meditation practice. The story actually just gets in the way. So it's kind of a relief to know here in this particular, sitting and meditating, you don't have to be involved in any story making. Isn't that great? I hope it's great. Unless you love your story so much. Yes?
I think going back to what you all were talking about there, if you actually have an aversion or anxiety or something, and you look at it and it
you realize, oh, this is an emotion, this is fear. Oftentimes when I'm sitting and I have I can name a feeling, a lot of times I want to feel it to get it out, rather than, I mean, not necessarily even having a story about it, but it's like, oh, there's fear. Oh, there's lots of fear there. And then it's like, naming it is great, because then it's like, I know what it is, but then I want to like fully allow it to surface so it comes up and then it's out. Otherwise, I feel like I just sort of walk around with this idea of, oh, there's a lot of fear there, fear, 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 fear there. And it doesn't, it just stays with me unless I discharge it.
Oh, you mean, it has useful to discharge or to have catharsis at times, but in the practice of mindfulness, I'm not actively acting on these things in terms of giving them, but trying to open to them and give them all the space to let them open and unfold and as much as they want. So when you feel a little bit of fear begins to arise, the practice of mindfulness is to not have any resistance to it, but simply to see it clearly for what it is and kind of get out of the way. And then the fear, if it wants to, has a chance to kind of blossom. You're petrified. You know, or same thing with anger. So it's a beautiful practice because you're allowed to really feel and give space to let the feelings really process themselves, so really come up and really surface and be there fully. But we don't act on them. And the difference is that when we act on stuff, if we act on anger, start beating, that the habit formation is in the mind. So it becomes easier to be afraid or easier to become angry in the future. But if you can sit still with it and use your mindfulness and awareness to feel it and let it move through you, and sit still with it and discover that ability to be still in the midst of that freedom of the emotion to be there, then you're more likely to get to the roots of it, and it exhausts itself. It's a lot better to have your fear exhaust itself than it is to have it discharge for a while until the next charge comes up. Mm-hmm. Make some sense? So then let's end with a few minutes of sitting. So with some strength of resolve, some firmness of resolve, really try to stay present for the next 5 breaths. Don't let your mind waver at all from the next 5 breaths. And then continue being mindful of your breathing. Let yourself become calm and peaceful on the breath. But when your mind gets pulled off into something else, some distraction or some other preoccupation, notice if it's one of the hindrances.